Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragenauer with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. Now, often I'll introduce my show with a little update on what's going on in the mad world of mental health, but I don't want to waste a minute today because my guest is Robert Whittaker, and I'm sure you're going to want to hear every word that he can communicate in the next hour. Bob is a journalist. He's winner of the George Polk Award in Medical Writing. He's the author of Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic. Let me repeat, these are two of the best books to read in the field. And you haven't heard me say that too often. Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic. His website, which is excellent, you haven't heard me say that too often either, is Mad in America. Bob is a journalist by trade, but he's actually a scientist. His work is very scientific. It has scientific validity, and I would include it in the most important scientific texts on the subject of psychiatry. Bob Whittaker, are you there?
I am, Dr. Bregan. It's nice to be here.
Yes, good to have you on. Call me Peter, Bob. We know each other well enough, and that's what folks call me on the air.
Okay, great.
Bob, your work is marvelous. It's important. Would you like to talk about how you got into this, or do you want to jump into your work? Take off where you want.
Well, we'll just start. I think it's somewhat important to understand how I got into this, just because it's you know, when you end up as criticizing the mainstream beliefs and all, people, the first thought is, oh, he has a bias or something like that, or he has an agenda. And I came through this precisely through the other door. I started writing about this in 1998 when I was doing a series for the Boston Globe on abuses of patients in psychiatric research settings. But at that time, I had completely conventional understanding, which went like this, is that the drugs fix chemical imbalances. We were making great progress in understanding the biology of mental disorders. The drugs that we were getting, the newer generation drugs, were much better than the old. The drugs had kicked off the psychopharmacological revolution. So I had, as a journalist, I had absolutely conventional understanding of what was true, so to speak. And then what happened while I was doing that series, I came upon two outcome studies that sort of belied that, what I knew to be true. One was a study done, I think it was in 1994, by Ross Baldessarini and others at Harvard Medical School, and they reported that outcomes for schizophrenia patients had actually declined in the last 15 years and were now no better than they had been in the first half of the 20th century, going all the way back to 1900. So my immediate question is, well, that I thought we were making great progress, so why would they be no better than 100 years earlier? That was one. And then the second series of studies were studies done by the World Health Organization, and they did two such studies, in which they compared outcomes in three poor countries, what they call developing countries, and that was India, Nigeria, and Colombia, with outcomes in the U.S. and I think it was six other developed countries. And each time they found that outcomes were much better in the poor countries. And they actually concluded, and this was really the one phrase that got me curious and launched me on this larger reporting journey, was living in a developed country is, quote, a strong predictor. You won't have a good outcome, you won't have a good outcome, you won't fully recover, et cetera. And I wondered, well, why would living in a developed country be a marker for a poor outcome? Because, of course, one of the things we're so proud of in Western countries is our medicine. So, and that was a surprise. And then the real surprise for me was, then I looked at those studies, looked at them in depth, and you find that after the first such studies, the World Health Organization investigators, who were Western doctors, Western researchers, said, aha, maybe the reason for the better outcomes in the poor countries is that the patients there are more medication compliant. And this was a study of schizophrenia, so they took their antipsychotics more regularly. So they monitored antipsychotic use in that second study, and they found that in the poor countries, only 16% of patients were regularly maintained on the drugs, Whereas, of course, here in the United States and other developed countries, continual medication use, antipsychotic use, is the standard of care. So you can see why that immediately raised the curiosity for me, because my understanding was that these medications were essential, they dramatically improved long-term outcomes, and yet here was a study by the World Health Organization that really threw that belief into question. So and I really wrote Mad in America. I got a book contract to try to understand why living in a developed country would be a marker for a poor outcome. And I think what's important for our discussion is this. I came into this whole arena, which is a controversy arena, as a completely conventional, with completely conventional beliefs.
Well, good work. And then go on to talk some more just about your evolution.
Sure. So my first book, Mad in America, initially started to figure out why schizophrenia patients had such poor outcomes in the U.S. and other rich countries. And when I started doing that book, it became clear to me that to understand that answer, that question, I needed to go back through history in a certain sense and see how we've conceived a mental illness, what we call mental illness, over time. That's number one, to see how those conceptions have changed. Number two, also to see how throughout history, no matter what they were doing to people, they always found them effective, right? I mean, whatever the therapy of the day was, it was seen as effective. And then third, to see that throughout history, there's a real disparity between what the psychiatrists say is effective and their perceptions of their therapies versus the perceptions of those who are treated, who often have a very different perspective on the merits of these treatments. So that past became like a foil for understanding the present. And you've written on this extensively, and I certainly went to school on you for many, many ways, and this is one of the ways I went on to school on your work, was that, again, the conventional wisdom is you have this period before the arrival of Thorazine in asylum medicine, and then Thorazine makes this break, that maybe there was these bad old days, but this launches this psychopharmacological revolution and this great leap forward. But what you can see if you actually follow the history forward, and you did this, I don't know which book it was, maybe Toxic Psychiatry, you see that, in 1949, Egas Moniz, the inventor of lobotomy as a surgery for, quote, the mentally ill, won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for having invented that surgery. And then when Thorazine comes in first into asylum medicine, you see people comparing it to surgical lobotomies, calling it a chemical lobotomy. But they're not comparing it as a negative. They're comparing it as a positive because it's causing a change in being very similar to what was done with the surgery. So once you see that link, you see that the drugs, rather than making this great break from the past, really you can find a continual line into the present, which I think is so important. Anyway, that was my first book, Mad in America, and it was controversial. It got me in trouble for the first time. And actually, what happened after I published that book, my agent and my editor said, don't write any more about psychiatry. It's too controversial. You'll ruin your career. And so I actually wrote another couple books off this topic of psychiatry. But what happened is people kept asking me, what about outcomes for bipolar disorder or all these childhood disorders and especially longer term outcomes, depression, etc. So what I wanted to do with An Anatomy of an Epidemic was to look what science and history have to tell us about how this paradigm of care, how do they affect long-term outcomes of people diagnosed with schizophrenia or depression or manic depressive illness or anxiety. And just so that's number one. And number two, what is happening to the kids long-term who are being diagnosed and medicated? And then the third thing I was looking at in this Anatomy of an Epidemic is this. You see this extraordinary rise in the number of people on government disability due to mental illness in the last 20 years, ever since the arrival of Prozac. Now, normally, when you have a great medical advance, you'll see the burden of that illness decline in a society, right? And you get more people treated. But here, the more people are treated, the burden has gone up dramatically. So I wanted to look at this question. Is it possible we're creating mental patients? Is it possible with this paradigm of care we're creating disabled mental patients? And it's pretty easy to see in the science that there are these pathways that in fact take mild problems, milder, say, bouts of depression, and they convert them into a more chronic disorder and even a disabling disorder. nothing of this is new to you, but it was new to me in some ways. And certainly I think what I hope the book has done is, you know, helped people focus on long-term outcomes and this rising burden of mental illness and this fact of, are we creating mental patients?
Now, since writing these two books, you've really become a very positive force in the field of psychiatric reform. Talk some about that, about your relationship with some of the groups that you're working with, and sure, if you're comfortable going into all that.
Sure. Well, what has happened, something really has happened that's pretty interesting with Anatomy of an Epidemic. So let me go back to Mad in America. Mad in America, in a way, I was embraced a lot by, you know, peer groups, whatever you want to call people diagnosed, you know, survivor groups, that sort of thing. And I think one reason I was embraced was I tried to incorporate their perspective, their viewpoints into this history. And so I think in many ways they felt like, aha, this is a history that in some ways validates us, honors us, that sort of thing. And that's really who really embraced me after the first book. Now, this book came out, Anatomy of an Epidemic, and it's a really, as you mentioned in your intro, it's a very scientific book. It's a lot of, you know, scientific results, that sort of thing. And I did get embraced again by some of the peer groups. And of course, I got pretty heavily criticized by defenders of the faith as well. But as time went on, what has increasingly happened is that even mainstream groups are starting to invite me to give talks. So I've even been invited to give talks to, say, grand rounds at different medical schools. I've been given I was actually invited to give a talk to the American Psychiatric Association, recently to the Group for the Advancement of Psychiatry. And now, as you might imagine, those are very tense moments, a lot of unhappy people in the audience. But I think what's happening is people are reading the book and seeing it that it's their literature, it's their outcomes, and if you put all their outcomes together in this story of history and science, it does tell of a failed paradigm of care, and at least some people are trying to respond to that. And I think in terms of why maybe this book and me, and then we can go to the website, are maybe having some foothold in this, you know, trying to stir societal discussion on what we might do differently and what might be really terribly wrong with our current paradigm of care, is that the second book really talks their language. It talks the language of biological psychiatry. It looks at their studies done by the NIMH, done by governments, et cetera. It's not even really, we're not even looking at the pharma funding studies. We're looking at government-funded studies. And when you, and so it's their literature brought together into a coherent narrative that, excuse me, that belies the common wisdom.
Take a break.
I just got a glass of water.
You're listening to Robert Whitaker, who is doing some of the best research work in the field of psychiatry today. And he's also inspiring a lot of people, I think, to get involved in new ways in psychiatric reform. Bob, you get your voice back?
I don't know. Got something in my throat there.
Supposed to happen to me. I'm the old guy.
I'm getting up there too, Peter. You know, I think maybe if you talk about how it may be inspiring others to get involved, what has happened in the past 20, 25 years, you know, psychiatry, the drug companies have been so successful in, you know, expanding the markets for these drugs and getting us as a society to think of ourselves as, you know, suffering from a mental disorder. I mean, I've been doing a lot of talks at schools, academic schools, colleges, et cetera, and I am told repeatedly now that about 30% of the entering freshmen have a diagnosis and a prescription when they arrive on school. So think about that, 30% of the kids. So anyway, I think it's become so pervasive in our society, the use of these drugs, the expanded diagnostics, the prescribing of these drugs, the kids, the diagnosing, that our society as a whole is really trying to start to say, we have to grapple with this. Does this make sense? Is it improving our society? Is it really healthy for our kids? And so I think, or what I hope is that Anatomy of an Epidemic and maybe the website becomes a way for sort of people who in the past might not have got involved in thinking about mental health and the care of, quote, mental disorders, people with mental disorders. And I think it just becomes a gateway for thinking about it in a critical manner and in a way that, we have so much sort of brainwashing, really, but you know what I mean. We have the thought leaders, the experts at academic medical centers who for many, many years have been telling us about this great progress, how these drugs fix chemical imbalances and how effective and safe the drugs are without really much skepticism or criticism. And then, of course, we have the ads on TV, which tell that message as well. And there's, of course, been some really strong criticism and skepticism. And, you know, you're at the forefront of that for many, many, many years. And the only thing I think I'm adding to this is that the ways I think the defenders of the faith have tried to, make sure that this conversation doesn't happen is to sort of marginalize the critics like yourself, Lauren Mosher, et cetera, and say they have an agenda of their own. They have this bias. And, of course, you know, they'll throw out other sort of character assassination things. I think a little bit with me it's been harder for them to do that because I come from outside. I just come from a journalist perspective. It's not like I'm riding any other horse, any other therapeutic horse. I had some sort of good journalistic credentials before I started on this topic. So I hope, if indeed what you say is true, that inspiring new people to get involved, I would say it's hopefully for that reason.
Talk about another aspect of your work, which is getting into alternative. You've done some good work. You've actually gone and visited some of the more alternative organizations. So maybe talk about that some.
Sure. I mean, so what I did in Anatomy of an Epidemic is, like I said, I tried to flesh out what is history and science telling us about how these medications affect long-term outcomes. And what I think you find is quite strong, I think the evidence is quite clear, is a couple of things. It's one that this paradigm of care increases the chronicity of the disorder. And what that I mean is if you look at what we might have seen in sort of more natural outcomes, unmedicated outcomes, you'll see a lot of episodic problems, right? People have an episode of depression, get better. They'll have an episode of mania, and they'll get better. They'll have an episode of psychosis and get better. And the percentage of that, those first cohorts of suffering an episode of distress that became chronic was relatively small. And I think that's even true for psychotic episodes. But now, once you enter the system and you get medicated, you see these things run really chronic courses over the long term. So that's one. You see that failure. You see a lot of side effects with the drugs. You do see cognitive problems with the drugs. You see physical problems, etc. So once you have that sort of basic review of the evidence base, then you say, well, are there programs out there that are doing things differently that are getting better outcomes? And there are, of course. And one of the first ones I went to was in northern Finland. There's a place called Western Lapland. It's a district there. And they have developed a form of care called open dialogue therapy. And it really goes back to 1969, if you look at the roots of it. It has its roots in both psychotherapy and family therapy. And it's for psychotic patients. And the key in this is this. It's well documented. They've done one five-year study after another five-year study. And in each case, they have by far the best five-year outcomes in the Western world. And what are their outcomes? One, within 5 years, if you look at their first episode patients, 80% are really asymptomatic and working or back in school. Only 20% have become sort of chronically, have a chronic problem. Think about in the United States, if you follow the first episode cohort of people with psychosis and followed them for 5 years, you'd see a lot of chronicity. You'd see people maintained on antipsychotics. You'd see a lot of continuing psychotic symptoms, a lot of disability, etc. So right away we see there in northern Finland, which is a Western country, outcomes that are dramatically better. And then you want to ask yourself, well, what do they do there? What you find is, first of all, is A, they have reconceptualized the disorder. So instead of saying psychosis is a brain disease due to a chemical imbalance, they say this. psychosis arises from the in-between spaces of people. In other words, from this, how people interact with each other. And the psychotic person bears the burden of making manifest or making known this disruption in the social web. So right away, that takes it away from someone having this chronic broken brain and puts it more into a situational context. And whether that's right or not, we don't even need to go into that. It's just much more optimistic. And then second of all, they rethought their use of antipsychotic drugs. They actually try to avoid initial use of the antipsychotics because they really don't want people to start down that medicated path, number one. They also find that people respond better to therapy if they're not so heavily sedated. So 5 years after initial diagnosis, 67% of their patients have never been exposed to an antipsychotic medication. So only one-third have ever been put on an antipsychotic. And then in terms of the percentage who are maintained on antipsychotics long-term, it's only 20%. So here you have, what do you have there? A, you have a program that with documented good outcomes that are remarkably better than ours. Two, you have a different conception. And three, you have a very different protocol for using the medications. And that last part is so powerful for this reason. Here in the United States, we considered, against standard of care not to immediately medicate with antipsychotics. And it's really against, for psychotic patients, and it's for anyone diagnosed with schizophrenia, it's against standard of care to withdraw that patient from the drugs. And yet when we go through the Western world and we find the best long-term outcomes, the best documented long-term outcomes, where do we find them? We find them in a society that uses the drugs very sparingly in a very different manner. So that's why I went to that solution, say, for schizophrenia. Well documented, much better outcomes, different conception, and different use of the medications. And you would think their success would get people here to say, well, maybe we should try to copy that and rethink our paradigm of care. Of course, that doesn't really happen, but you'd think so. So that was one solution that I looked at. Another solution I looked at, just to jump to the other end of this, was looking
at... Let me give you a voice of break and add a little bit to what you're saying. I think that program is really incredible. And it doesn't end up influencing psychiatry. Large, and in fact, the program in Lapland didn't even influence the rest of the country, which is Finland.
Right. So why not?
Bob, you keep talking for a minute, and I've got call in on a plane.
Okay, yeah,
so
I'm losing
your show for a few minutes now, Bob.
Okay, I'll run the show because I am losing here for a second. Okay, so why doesn't open dialogue therapy get embraced by the rest of Finland, which is an obvious question I asked the people in Western Lapland when I went there. And I went there, I think it was in the fall of 2010. The answer is this. The influence of the pharmaceutical companies, one of the ways that pharmaceutical companies have expanded their market in country after country, is they go into these other countries and they start making payments to the doctors, the psychiatrists at the academic medical schools. And by making payments, I mean they hire them to be speakers. They hire them to be consultants. They hire them to be advisors. So what they do is they co-opt within the country the sort of experts, those with prestige. And they have done that in Finland as well. And so now we have this smaller community up in northern Finland, Western Lapland, which only has a population of 70,000, and it does something different. Well, you have those with academic prestige that, in fact, have a vested interest to not respond to what's happening in Western Lapland because it would challenge the very paradigm of care they're being paid to sell, in essence. And by the way, the interesting thing about this not being adapted in the rest of Finland is this project actually arose out of a national study, a six-site study done at six different centers in Finland going back to 1992. And in that study, the best outcomes were seen in places like Tornio in Western Lapland where they weren't using medications as a matter of course. So even though it was a national study, even though this was the finding...
Hey, Bob, by the way, I'm back. So just keep on going, and we're
okay.
Back on the air again.
That's good. I can hear you because I couldn't hear you there for a second.
Now, what happened is, just for all of you listening, this was just a computer connection loss somehow. It's on a network. It's not got to do with my end, really, or the other end. It's a network problem. So, Bob, catch me up with what you've been saying for 2 minutes in a sentence.
Well, yeah, I was just saying I was just going over why the rest of Finland has not adopted this superior model of care that has arisen in Western Lapland, because of course you think it would. They've even done cost studies. They have the lowest per capita expenditure now in Western Lapland. And what I was just saying is the reason is that as pharmaceutical companies have opened up other markets or developed other markets in other countries, they follow a very simple model. They go into those countries and they negotiate agreements with the doctors, psychiatrists at academic medical centers, and hire them to be speakers, consultants, and advisors. And once they get the country's prestigious people, you know, co-opted in that way, you know, standards of care tend to follow drug, you know, the same sort of drug-based model we have here in the United States. And that's clearly what has happened in Finland. And the irony is that the outcomes, schizophrenia outcomes in the rest of Finland aren't good. The outcomes for first episode patients in the rest of Finland aren't good. But nevertheless, this influence of pharma money is so powerful, it has kept open dialogue from spreading throughout the rest of Finland.
And by the way, folks who want to learn about this, there's stuff in my book, Medication Madness, about open dialogue. There's a lot of stuff in Bob's latest book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, about open dialogue. And you can Google open dialogue, and you'll find them. One of the things I found really fascinating is that the disability rates went down and in Lapland compared to the rest of the country. And there's very few diagnosed schizophrenics anymore there because technically if you recover in 6 months, it's not a schizophrenic disorder. So they're really changing things there, but having so very little effect on the rest of the world. But you're doing a very good job in promoting it and what they're doing, and I'm doing my best to add my voice to it.
It is getting out there with different voices sort of promoting it. I mean, there's a conference in Finland coming up this late August, and there's going to be people coming from the other Scandinavian countries, and there's some people in Germany interested. I mean, you're right. You think people would be running to embrace it, and the fact that schizophrenia in some ways is disappearing in that part of Finland, it used to have something like, it's a population of 70,000. It used to have something like 27 new cases of schizophrenia per year. And if you do the math, that's a high number of new cases in a population of 70,000. This goes back to the late 80s. Now they're down to 2 or 3 cases per year, a 90% drop, and it's for the exact reason you said. These people are not remaining psychotic long enough to sort of move into the schizophrenia diagnosis. And as what the people who've developed open dialogue will tell you, that they have completely changed their understanding of the psychotic disorders because of this.
Yeah. You know, I got started, as you know, Bob, and some of my listeners know, I got started working with state mental hospital patients as an 18-year-old when I was a college volunteer. So my basic notion about what works and doesn't work came working in the worst settings on earth, which were the 1954-1955 state mental hospitals. I worked in them before and after the drugs came in. And we found that as case aides with a little supervision, and I mean a little, just once a week in a group from a social worker, that we could get our own patients out of the mental hospital, something no one expected. We got most of our patients out of the mental hospital within the first year, the great majority of them. I wrote that up in Toxic Psychiatry, and we had very good follow-up on them as well. And in my own practice, I treat initial episode that what we would call psychosis or schizophrenia through a good, solid, trusting relationship and helping bring the person back from their break with reality, because I believe that a break from reality is actually a break from human reality. It's a break in social relationship, very much as the open dialogue people talk about. And they use this phrase that the schizophrenia is in between the people.
Right.
And Martin Buber, who wrote about I-Thou relationships, had that concept. They may have gotten it from him. He talked about that real relationships invoked a spiritual quality for him. And I'm not sure they're talking about a spiritual quality, but a spiritual quality of I and thou that was in between the people and not just of the individual people. We're going to go to break, and maybe when we come back, Bob, if you feel like it, you talked some about the attacks that you ran into, the surprise perhaps that you had about this. If you're comfortable with it, when
sure.
we come back, we can talk about some of what you went through. In the meanwhile, we'll go to music and go to the break on Progressive Radio Network.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and you are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour. This is a really fine show. It is just so appropriate to everything that matters in the field of mental health. Bob Whitaker, marvelous writer, Mad in America, Anatomy of an Epidemic, scientist as well as journalist, in my opinion, doing really, really good work. Bob, earlier you brought up that people like myself and Lauren Mosier, Lauren, by the way, folks may not, know who he is. Lauren Mosier is a psychiatrist who's no longer with us, who did marvelous work in something called Soteria House, which I've mentioned before on this show and which both Bob and I write about, in which he showed here in the United States that people being sent to a residential home-like setting with a first break diagnosis, schizophrenic or psychotic, and who didn't receive medication in most of the studies, or in a small percentage of them got medication, and they were treated not by trained professionals but by people selected for their empathic capacities, that these residential places did, by any standard, as well as the randomly selected, so this is a controlled study, randomly selected folks who went into the regular mental health system. But they also did far better in that they didn't get adverse drug effects. They didn't get tardive dyskinesia, and they didn't get neuroleptic malignant syndrome, and they didn't get lobotomized. And, of course, they got a feeling that they themselves were able to recover without having to rely on these chemicals and on the authorities. Well, Lauren, of course, took a lot of grief from the psychiatric establishment. He actually was forced to leave his position as director of the Schizophrenia Center at the National Institute of Mental Health, where he did wonderful, marvelous research, and, of course, was roundly criticized within the profession. And I don't talk about it much, but I've taken my own lumps. And I know that, Bob, you've been very, very aware of that, and I think it's kind of you to acknowledge, that my own work and my own influence on your, especially on your early work, I'm sure.
No question about it.
But, I know you've worked hard to be this independent person. And what have you run into trying to hold that position in terms of people dismissing you and criticizing you?
Well, it's been tough. I mean, it's been hard. After Mad in America, there were some real slams by defenders of the faith. One of my favorite one was someone called it the most disingenuous book ever written. So anyway, you know, you get those things, and what you'll have is people say, oh, he's biased, he's cherry-picking his studies, that sort of thing. With the first book, E. Fuller Torrey said, oh, it sounds like it was written by a Scientologist. They always throw that at people to try to discredit people. So that was the first one, but what happened with Mad in America after time, it gradually gained a certain credibility within mainstream sort of media situations. I mean, Discover Magazine picked it as one of the best science books, and I think the American Library Association picked it as one of the best history books. So that actually in some colleges now use it as a text. So, you know, I got the initial hit, but I sort of recovered from it there. So now Anatomy of an Epidemic comes out 2 years ago. And the very morning it comes out, there's this review that appears in the Boston Globe. And it's written by a sleep specialist, a pediatric sleep specialist at one of the Harvard hospitals. I think it might have been Children's, actually. And it is such a hit job. Among other things, it ends up comparing me to an AIDS denier. And it says, you know...
Oh, God.
Yeah, this is the first day. And it says, you know, and it compares me also to a South African dictator who, by reason of denying AIDS, had caused hundreds of thousands of deaths. And they're basically saying this book is dangerous. It could cause hundreds of thousands of deaths. And he said something like, no one who's at all serious can deny that these medications have helped millions of people, okay? And then if you go through the review, he said I said stuff I didn't say and all this stuff. Well, and this guy had never, ever written a review for the Boston Globe before, right? So why does he show up that day?
And that's your home newspaper.
That's right.
I woke up
this morning and I just said, oh, Christ.
Oh, my.
So
betrayal.
But I look at this and I say, well, why does this appear by this person? Well, if you think about it, first of all, he does prescribe drugs to kids, psychiatric drugs. But two, if a group, and his department actually gets a lot of money from pharmaceutical companies, but if you want to like trash somebody and sort of put this book down right from the beginning, sort of say to the public, don't read this, you don't want a psychiatrist to write it. Because then it might seem self-interested. But if you can get someone with a Harvard credential, that's quite good, right? And it was really effective, Peter. In some ways, it was quite brilliant the way it was done. And I had my radio interviews canceled. No newspaper reviewed the book after this. And this was my fourth book, okay? And all my previous books had gotten some recognition as notable books of the year thing, etc. So you come to your fourth book, you can expect newspaper reviews, you can expect to do some radio interviews. Utter silence. Radio interviews canceled. No other newspaper reviewed the book. Just it was a signal to the mainstream media. Do not review this book. It's a crank job or whatever. So that happened, and the book started to die, to be honest with you. Sales were terrible. My agent said, oh, boy, this is awful. You're screwed now, because if you're trying to make a living writing books, you got to have some sort of sales record. And then what happened was that the peer community started taking up and started talking about it, and sales started coming up. So I started to recover from this first shot. Now, the second shot was I was invited by... There's an annual conference, which you know well, the Alternatives Conference, which is funded by SAMHSA, which is a federal agency. And the National Empowerment Center this year, and this was in 2010, was asked to put together the speaker agenda. And so they asked me to give the keynote. So I got invited, and I was all set to do the keynote, and then I got disinvited. And basically SAMHSA told National Empowerment Center, and who knows what political pressure was on, they had to disinvite me. In other words, I was going to talk about things that were beyond the pale in our country, even though all I was going to do is review the science. And what happened then at that point is, again, peer community, Mind Freedom and others, came to my rescue and began doing a protest. They began calling SAMHSA. They began calling the White House, saying, you know, this is their conference and they should be allowed to invite me. And so I got re-invited. But this shows how crazy this is. So I got re-invited, but I got re-invited with this unbelievable caveat. They said, you'll be allowed to give your talk, and then we will bring a psychiatrist up to give a talk of equal length in which he will basically denounce you and tell people everything you just heard is wrong, and you won't be allowed to respond, okay? So in other words, I go up there. So imagine an invitation to give a keynote where they're going to immediately then attack you. But I said, to heck with it, I'll do it. And something really interesting happened, because basically this other psychiatrist was supposed to give the rebuttal. So I give up there, and I go up there, and I give this very scientific talk. I just go through different science studies, etc. And then the rebuttal goes like this. The rebuttal goes like, he doesn't cite a single study. He basically says this. Reading this book is like riding down the highway and looking at the car crashes. He should pay more attention to the cars that are running freely on the highway. I mean, he makes no sense. And then he says, you know, it's not just psychiatry where therapies actually do more harm than good over the long term. And you saw people in the audience going, what? And it turned, I think what had happened is this psychiatrist, I believe, had gone to one of the local academic centers and said, okay, you tell me where Whitaker is wrong, and you tell me what studies I can bring forth to say, here's our studies showing that our medications help long-term outcomes. And what I saw, and I think I was leaked the answer, was this. We've gone through Whitaker's sources, and, quote, unfortunately, he's very accurate. And here's why this was important. This was like a visible time when the mainstream psychiatry could rebut me, right? That's the way it was set up. And what happened at this very visible forum, there was no rebuttal, no sort of scientific rebuttal. So you see here was this sort of second attack on my character, get disinvited, but nevertheless survive that. And I could go on. There's been different critical pieces, et cetera. One of the more interesting sort of moments to discredit me occurred at Massachusetts General Hospital. I initially spoke to a book group out there, went fine. Then I spoke to the schizophrenia group, went fine. And then I got invited to give a grand rounds. And when I was invited, they said, your work's important. It's really important we discuss this scientific literature. And what do you want to talk about? And I said, well, let's review the literature for schizophrenia. They say, okay, send in your slides a month early. I send in my slides. And then I'm told there's going to be a rebuttal. And instead of getting a full hour, I'll get a half hour. And I say, fine. And they're not a rebuttal. There'll be someone within the department talk about what they see the evidence is for schizophrenia. I say, fine, that'll be great. We'll have a real airing of the evidence. And I said, but will I get to see these slides, you know, sometime before? Oh, yeah, sure, we'll get them to you 2 weeks before. 2 weeks before, no slides. A week before, no slides. 3 days before, no slides. 2 days before, no slides. Finally, I get an email saying, here's our slides, although the slides weren't attached. So finally, I think it was about 12 hours before it, I get the slides, and it has nothing to do with sort of a discussion about antipsychotics. It's just a full-fledged attack on me. It begins with, it's titled a rebuttal of, you know, anatomy of an epidemic. Then there's an ad hominem attack. I'm compared to Sarah Palin. They use a quote from Paul Krugman that says, never assume malice when profound ignorance remains a real possibility. And this guy went through 20 minutes, and I you can even go on my website and I show how he miscited data, etc. But it ended with, the last slide was, anatomy of an epidemic should come with a black box warning that reading it is dangerous to your health. And then what happened with that was, that got picked up by a local NPR station, and the way the NPR station said is, Whitaker's book has been refuted by reputable Boston psychiatrist. Now that message went out now to sort of around the country. I don't know who was, I think NAMI people were promoting, etc. And now I started getting talks canceled again, because the message was, you know, reputable Boston psychiatrists have refuted the book. And the amazing thing is, you can go to that refutation, that rebuttal, and it's just so intellectually dishonest and ludicrous. And what it really shows is that there isn't a good rebuttal. And later I was told, by the way, about that MGH setting, that one of the reasons it was set up that way is so many residents were going to the faculty and saying, what's up with this? Why weren't we taught this? Why weren't we taught about these studies? This tells us a totally different story. And part of that sort of effort to humiliate me at that moment was for the faculty, or certain people in the faculty, to do so in front of the residents, to sort of regain the prestige, et cetera. So, and you can go on, you know, any time like the press, it seems like my name comes up, it's always controversial author, and you can go on the web and people say I'm biased or cherry-picking, but they can't ever say why. I will tell you this, since Mad in America, I really haven't been allowed to write about psychiatry and psychiatric medications in general interest publications, say magazines. I used to write for magazines. And it's because, you know, when you break with the common wisdom, you're seen as, it doesn't matter how good of a reporter you are, or how careful a reporter you are, or that they never find mistakes, you're just seen as biased for breaking with common wisdom. So it is, listen, I didn't pay any sort of price like you did, or Lauren Mosher did, or what we've seen other professionals have done, but it hasn't been easy, and there certainly have been very public attacks.
Well, you sound, Bob, like you've paid quite a considerable price, actually.
Well, in some ways, yes. I mean, you know, sure, in some ways, yes.
You know, I think the one place that I ever disagreed with you about was your sense that the controversiality that surrounded me and surrounded Lauren Mosher and others had something to do with something other than the simple fact we were speaking the truth, that it didn't have to do with the fact that we were even part of the psychiatric establishment, that the only reason we were attacked was that we had a good effect. And I think you are just living proof of that, that the reason we get attacked, whether it's me or you or Lauren Mosher, the reason we get attacked is in measure to the good effect we're having.
Yeah, I think I probably didn't appreciate that as much, that it is a sign that you're having some effect.
Yes, I've taken to saying with pride that I've earned all of my enemies, earned them through hard, hard work and truth-telling.
Right. That's a good way to put it. So your scars are well-earned.
And the enemies. And, you know, you're doing very good work. You know, my wife is on the advisory council of Mother Bear,
mm-hmm.
and I have a sense that that all of that actually originated in part from your work. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. This is true. So what happened was, after Anatomy of an Epidemic came out, I did start hearing from some people, psychiatrists and all, saying, well, we really need to think about this. Can you put us together with like-minded psychiatrists? So I sort of built a listserv of psychiatrists who began to talk to each other. And then there were some people in Oregon who were providers of mental health care, including a county director, one of the former state commissioners of mental health, the current director of community mental health programs. They kept bringing me out to Oregon to talk about the book. And finally they said, boy, we really need to have a symposium where we start fleshing out what we might do differently. So once they wanted to have that symposium, it needed to get funding to make it happen. And I managed to find someone who would donate the funding to make it happen. But then I needed to create a 501(c), a nonprofit, to sort of accept that donation. And out of that came what's called the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. And I just helped it get started, helped that first symposium happen, and then I resigned from the foundation because two reasons. One, it was a conflict for a journalist to be part of the foundation, and two, I knew that the foundation might have trouble because, you know, it'd be seen as so attached to me, and that would give reason to people attack it. Anyway, the foundation formed. It's called the Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care. They've now raised about $3 million. They're hoping to raise $200 million. And what have they done so far? One, they have given at least some funding commitment to do two different first episode psychotic projects, in which are loosely modeled on the Open Dialogue Project. And if they can get IRB approval, will involve not immediately medicating first-episode psychosis with antipsychotics. And I think this will be the first time such studies have been done since the 1970s. So that's pretty remarkable to reopen this question of, really, should we be putting everybody on antipsychotics when they come in with, quote, psychotic symptoms? That's profound, I think, that they're doing that. And they've given some money to Mind Freedom. They're helping establish a Hearing Voices network in this country. They've funded a symposium, and I think they're going to fund a symposium on sort of the medicating of children. And what's beautiful about the foundation is, and they have a scientific advisory board, and what's beautiful about it is that it's really coming from sort of a mainstream idea. In other words, a lot of the people behind it are you know, either involved in the provision of care or, you know, not long ago were even sort of biological psychiatry type people, and they're changing their mind and their tune because of what they see as the evidence. So that's up. Now, as an offshoot of that, one of the big funders or supporters and on the board of Foundation for Excellence in Mental Health Care is Don Cooper, and his wife, and they have a child with a diagnosis of schizophrenia. Anyway, his wife then started this network called the Mother Bear Network, which is supposed to be basically an association of family members, but as a counterpoint to NAMI. We know NAMI has a certain story out there that has really promoted the idea of chemical, you know, the broken brain. And Mother Bear is supposed to be a network that will promote, a family network that promotes a different story. And the different story will be so much more optimistic. It will be about psychiatric distress arising from these in-between spaces. It will be talking about much more subtle use of the medications, much more cautious use of the medications. And so those did originate with an anatomy of an epidemic, and that's really satisfying to see that happen.
Yeah, I think that's just fabulous what you've been able to do, working with other people and getting that new organization going. We're very, very pleased to be having members of that group come to our conference in April, our annual conference of the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. They're also going to be holding sponsoring a conference in Syracuse in the fall, and I'll be at that, and Ginger will be there. And we're just very glad to be involved in these projects and to be benefiting from work that you created. I think you're just doing excellent work. And
thanks. But as you know, it's a collective effort. So.
Oh, God, yes. Yes, it is.
So do you know that conference in the fall, I think it's September 29th or something, is that devoted to children or is it just devoted?
I think it's children and families.
Children and families, right, which is fantastic.
If Ginger's listening, she can correct me and come in from the other office and let me know if I'm off on that. But I think it's on children and families.
Fantastic.
And we're really looking forward to that. And I think you and I may be on the stage at the same time.
I think that's correct. That's right.
For at least one of the presentations. I think things are going to be really moving ahead in the reform movement. People are going to be working more and more together. And I think a lot is going to be happening. We're finding, Bob, that the theme, you know, we decided to emphasize the essence of good therapy, of good help of all kinds, which begins with empathy and caring.
Right.
And we are just finding in our organization, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, we're just finding an incredible rallying around this concept of caring and empathy as the center of all the therapeutic approaches. And there can be such an infinite variety of them, from individual therapy to state-run program in Lapland, you know, to individual research projects or to educational changes. And all of them really depend on this kind of caring approach. One of the things I'm trying to do more and more is to not just focus on our own organization, but Ginger and I, we're going to be speaking to other groups and bringing other groups together. And I think there is a very positive change going on out there. I know that when I speak in public now and to most professional organizations, the reception now is so different from 10, 12 years ago. Yes, go ahead.
No, I think you're right. I think it's changing. I think that's a sign of two things. One, the existing paradigm of care is being seen by society as a failed paradigm of care, so which makes it you know, society ready for a paradigm shift, so to speak. And then the other thing, it just makes sense, right?
It makes good sense. Bob, it's wrap-up time here. Let me, again, congratulate you on your work. I've been talking with Robert Whitaker, journalist and scientist. Mad in America, his first book in the field of psychiatry, and then Anatomy of an Epidemic, a book. Both books, I think, should be required reading in the field. He has an excellent website. Go to his website, Mad in America. Go to my websites. You'll get a real wonderful dose of what's happening that's best in this field. Thanks very, very much for being on the show, Bob. And I'm sure I'll just be calling you back soon and asking you to come on again.
Well, thanks very much, Peter. It's been a real pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.